Welcome to the deep dive. You know the deal. This is where we take that huge stack of sources, the research, the historical data.
All the really dense stuff.
Exactly. And we distill it for you. We give you that shortcut to the core knowledge so you can walk away better informed.
And today we're diving into a claim you hear a lot, one that's often presented as maybe the strongest piece of archaeological evidence for the Book of Mormon.
That's right. We're talking about the existence of a place in the Arabian Peninsula called Nahum, spelled N-H-H-M.
Our sources are great for this because they lay out the argument from proponents, the claim of this amazing discovery.
And then they systematically evaluate it against the actual archaeology and geography. So our mission is clarity. We want to see just how settled this issue really is, based only on the data.
Okay, so to set the scene, you have to remember the Book of Mormon narrative. It starts around 600 BCE. Lehi and his family have just left Jerusalem.
And they're traveling through the Arabian wilderness.
Right. And in the Book of 1 Nephi, we're told that a patriarch named Ishmael dies and is, quote, buried in the place which was called Nahum. This is a key event.
It's a geographical marker, basically.
Exactly. It happens before they turn nearly eastward and head for the coast to build their ship.
And the power of the apologetic argument, the one you hear secondhand, is just so simple, right? It's that archaeologists found this ancient burial site called Nahum exactly where the Book of Mormon said it would be.
Right. And that Joseph Smith couldn't possibly have known that name in 1829.
I mean, we see quotes from proponents calling it basically subtle and the first actual archaeological evidence.
And when a claim is presented that strongly, you really have to.
Well,
you have to test the foundation it's built on.
Okay, so let's do that. Let's unpack it. The text says Nahum is in the most fertile parts of the wilderness and in the borders near the Red Sea. So where is the actual site that they point to?
The finding is three inscribed votive altars. They have the consonants NHM on them, and they were found at the Barren Temple, which is near Marib in modern-day Yemen.
Marib, Yemen.
Okay, so looking at a map, how far is that from the Red Sea?
It's a good distance. We're talking about 125 to 150 miles inland.
Wow. 150 miles. That is not a short trip. So how does that distance square with the description of being near the Red Sea?
Well, it creates an immediate problem, a huge one, actually. To get 150 miles inland, you have to cross this massive, rugged mountain range.
Okay.
So Nephi, who's the narrator in the text, he just wouldn't describe that location as being near the Red Sea. There's this giant topographical barrier in the way.
And what about the most fertile parts? I mean, is a mountainous desert region fertile?
No, not at all. That's another contradiction. The most fertile parts would have been along the coast or established trade routes, not deep inland in the mountains.
So we have a geographical mismatch right out of the gate. But Marib wasn't just some random spot in the desert, was it?
Not even close. Marib was the capital of the Sabian kingdom. You might know them as the people of Sheba from the Bible.
This was a major center of civilization. And around 600 BCE, our sources estimate the population of Marib was between 40 and 50,000 people.
Wait, hang on. Let me just process that. Lehi's family left Jerusalem, which had, what, maybe 20,000 people at the time?
20, 25,000, yeah.
So if they were near Marib, they were next to a city that was literally twice the size of the one they just came from.
Precisely. A massive, thriving hub of culture and trade.
This is what our sources call the significant absence, right?
Yes. If you're on this journey and you pass by or bury someone near a city twice the size of Jerusalem with its own powerful religion, its famous dam, you would mention it.
You would have to.
But the Book of Mormon narrative makes absolutely no mention of the Sabian people, their city, their religion, nothing. It's like writing a journal about a road trip across the U.S. and just forgetting to mention Chicago.
That's a stunning omission. Okay, so let's move from the location to the function of the site itself. The claim, the big one, is that Nahum was an ancient burial site.
And this is the critical point. The site is definitively not a burial place.
What is it then?
It's the Barren Temple, sometimes called the Throne of Bilcus. It was dedicated to the main Sabian god, a deity named Al-Maqwa. It was a state documentation center and a place for people to leave votive offerings.
Votive offerings? So like gifts to the god.
Exactly. The evidence isn't a tombstone. A good analogy would be finding a gift receipt to a god. It proves devotion, not burial.
And for Ishmael, a Jewish patriarch, to be buried at a pagan temple dedicated to a sun and moon god, I mean, that's a massive theological problem.
A huge one. And there's also the dating. While the inscriptions might fit the timeline, the temple itself is much older. It dates back to the 10th century BCE.
So 400 years before Lehi's journey even started.
Roughly, yeah.
Okay, let's drill down on the three letters that this whole thing is built on, NHM. What exactly does the full text on those altars say?
So on these three gift altars, there's a four-line inscription in South Arabic. It translates to, Bathar, son of Saudim, son of Naom, the Nemite, dedicated the gift to Al-Maqwa.
The Nemite. Okay, so NHM is in there. But how much of the total text are we talking about?
It's incredibly selective. There are 36 total consonants across the relevant text on the altars. The three letters N, H, and M represent less than 5% of the actual data.
Wow. So proponents are focusing on less than 5% of the evidence and just filtering out the other 95%.
That's a good way to put it. It's extreme cherry picking, especially when that other 95% actually undermines their claim.
Let's talk about that. The word Nemite, what does that tell us?
That is probably the most important linguistic detail. Nemite is what's called a gentilic. It means Bathar, the person dedicating the altar, was from the tribe or region of Nim, or NHM.
So he's identifying his origin.
Right, exactly. People would travel to the main religious center at Merib and note where they came from. This strongly implies that Bathar was outside his home region of NHM when he was at the temple.
Which means the temple itself isn't Nahom.
It can't be. It suggests the region of Nahom is somewhere else, probably about 25 miles away. The altars prove a tribe called Miam existed, sure, but not that the temple is Nahom.
And the inscription is in South Arabic, not Hebrew, which Nephi claims was the language on the plates.
Another mismatch.
So if the archaeology is this shaky, I mean, geographically wrong, functionally wrong, linguistically strained, it brings us back to the central question. Where did Joseph Smith get the name Nahom?
Well, the argument is that he couldn't have known it, that there was no way, but that's highly overstated.
How so?
Our sources found at least seven different maps published between 1751 and 1813 that clearly show a region named Nem or Nahim in that exact area.
So these maps were available in his time.
Absolutely. Yeah. And you think about early 19th century New York with all the information flowing around projects like the Erie Canal. It's entirely plausible he could have seen one or just heard about the name secondhand.
It becomes plausible, not impossible.
Exactly. Plausibility is the key.
Yeah.
But honestly, there's an even simpler, more probable source that doesn't require any maps at all.
Confusion.
The Bible itself.
The Bible.
Yeah. The Book of Nahum has the exact same NHM consonants.
Okay. A coincidence of letters, maybe?
Yeah.
But does it connect deeper than that?
It does. This is where it really stacks up. Apologists often argue that the name Nahom fits the narrative because it means comfort or mourning, and Ishmael had just died.
Right, the wordplay argument.
Well, there was a very popular, very influential biblical commentary at the time by a man named Adam Clark. It was well known in Joseph Smith's circle.
And what did it say?
Clark's commentary explicitly states that the name Nahom signifies comforter.
So,
yeah.
He had access to both the name, the NHM consonants, and the very wordplay apologists used to support it right there in a popular book.
He had everything he needed. Occam's razor suggests it's far more probable he got it from the Bible and a commentary than from an angel in golden plates.
That really changes the calculus. Okay, let's synthesize this. We've laid out a whole list of problems one has to ignore to accept this claim. Can we run through that checklist?
Sure. First, geography. You have to ignore that the site is 150 miles inland, across a mountain range, not near the Red Sea.
Okay. And second, you have to ignore the massive city of Merib, twice the size of Jerusalem, which is completely unmentioned in the narrative.
Third, you have to ignore the function. The site is a temple to a pagan god, Al-Maqwa. It is not a burial place.
Not a grave.
Right.
Fourth, the artifact itself. The inscription is on a religious gift, a votive altar, not a grave marker.
Fifth, you have to ignore the full text. The word Nemite clearly indicates a tribe or region other than the temple site itself.
And sixth, and this is the big one, you have to ignore that Joseph Smith had multiple plausible sources for the name, the meaning, and the context, from the Bible to contemporary maps.
When you lay it all out like that, you start to see a distinct pattern. And in scholarship, this pattern actually has a name. It's called parallel mania.
Parallel mania. Explain what that means.
It's the practice of finding one tiny detail that seems to align with your text. In this case, three letters, less than 5% of the evidence, and elevating it as proof.
While ignoring
all the overwhelming counter evidence, the other 95%, that contradicts your conclusion. It's confirmation bias dressed up as research.
So to bring it back to our mission for this deep dive, how settled is the Nahom argument, really?
It is entirely unsettled. I mean, to call it the strongest evidence is, it's just flimsy. It requires you to override known geography, archaeology, and historical plausibility, which is why you won't find any non-LDS, non-BYU scholars of South Arabian archaeology who support the claim.
So we navigated the sources, and the goal wasn't to argue against the text itself, but just to look at the viability of this one specific argument, to strip away the hype.
And that's the key takeaway for you, the listener. It's so important to seek out the full context, that other 95% of the data, because three letters can be made to prove almost anything if you're willing to ignore the 150 miles, the 33 other continents, and the pagan temple.
That difference between a tidy summary and the messy complete picture. That's the whole point of a deep dive. And this process raises a really important question for anyone interested in critical thinking.
It does. Often, the strongest evidence a group presents tells you less about the ancient claim and more about how far modern proponents will go to support their faith. So the question for you to think about is this. When you look at any historical or religious claim, how do you manage that very human desire to believe against the need for objective evidence? What do you accept on faith, and what do you insist has to be grounded in demonstrable, verifiable facts?
A great thought to end on. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive, and we encourage you to continue your own critical learning journey. We'll see you next time.